Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Candace Novak, and I represent 5-year-old minor child Marcella B., the appellant in this matter. This case is about whether or not we pay more than lip service to the notion that the best interest of the child is paramount in juvenile court proceedings. The present case, the undisputed evidence established that Marcella, 5-year-old girl who had been the victim of physical abuse, would likely suffer further emotional harm if forced to testify about the abuse in open court in the presence of her mother, the alleged abuser. And In re Danielle D. has recognized that a child has rights under the Nebraska Juvenile Code, and that a court should allow a child to testify in chambers at an adjudication hearing when there are legitimate concerns about forcing the child to testify in the presence of a parent. In this case, we indisputably raised legitimate concerns, but the juvenile court ignored the harm that would be inflicted upon Marcella and overruled our motion to allow in chambers testimony. We believe that the juvenile court erred in making this decision, and we're requesting that you reverse that decision. As the case stands, this 5-year-old child, Marcella, is in a no-win situation. As the state's primary witness at the adjudication, if Marcella does not testify due to fear of her mother, the state will likely fail to establish the allegations contained in its petition, and Marcella will return to the mother that's been accused of abusing her. If Marcella does testify in open court, then she endures further emotional trauma that the system is supposed to protect her from. This case is about creating a procedure that sincerely promotes the best interest of the child. In juvenile proceedings, the Nebraska statute and case law mandate that the best interest of the child outweigh every other consideration. The whole purpose of the juvenile code is to promote and protect the best interest of children, as established by Nebraska Revised Statute 43, Section 245. Additionally, Nebraska Revised Statute 43, Section 246 mandates that a judicial procedure be adopted which accomplishes the purpose and goals of the juvenile code, which include care and protection of the juvenile. It is ludicrous to think that the very legal system which is supposed to protect Marcella from harm would mandate a procedure that will indisputably inflict further harm upon her by forcing her to testify in front of her abuser mother, which the evidence establishes would result in harm. The witness at the motion for in-chambers testimony in-chambers hearing testified without objection that it would be harmful for Marcella to testify in open court in front of her mother regarding allegations of physical abuse that occurred while Marcella was in her mother's care. This evidence was undisputed. The court found such evidence to be credible, probative, and entitled to weight. There was no testimony offered in resistance to the motion.
Ms. Novak, could I interrupt you and take you to the jurisdictional issue?
Yes.
You are the appointed attorney for the child, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you filed this appeal?
Yes.
And I think the law is pretty clear that juvenile proceedings are special proceedings, and so we get down to whether or not there's a substantial right?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the substantial right affected here?
Your Honor, we would argue that the substantial right affected is a child's right to be free from harm. Furthermore, we would argue that this issue is otherwise unreviewable upon appeal because the harm that is inflicted upon the child in forcing her to testify in open court in front of her mother is unreviewable. The harm will essentially have been done, and the issue will be moot if the order stands.
From what source are you deriving this right to be free from harm? We're familiar, for example, when the parents' interests are being discussed in the juvenile context, that their constitutional right to liberty is the source of that, of their rights to the extent they're considered in juvenile proceedings. But from what constitutional provision or statutory provision are you deriving what seems to me a rather broadly stated right to be free from?
Well, I would refer again to Nebraska Revised Statute 43, Section 246, which mandate the judicial procedure to be adopted that accomplishes the purpose of the juvenile code, which is to protect the best interest of children. Furthermore, Your Honor, the Nebraska Supreme Court has held that children have a right to grow up in a wholesome and healthful atmosphere, free from abuse or injury. And the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit has held that children in foster care have the right to be free from the infliction of unnecessary harm while in foster care. We would simply argue that it's only logical that the right to be free from harm in a parental home, as well as the right to be free from harm in foster care, extends when children have become part of, and they've been removed from parental home and placed in foster care, and then they become an integral part of the judicial system that's seeking to protect them. We argue that that right to be free from harm should extend throughout the proceedings, from the time they're removed, throughout the judicial proceedings, as well as while they are placed in foster care. We would further argue that the juvenile court erred in applying an incorrect standard and concluding that the evidence produced did not meet the standard as set forth in Daniel D., which holds that a child should be allowed to testify in chambers at an adjudication hearing where there are legitimate concerns about the child testifying in the presence of the parent. The unrebutted evidence established that it would be harmful for Marcella to testify in open court in the presence of her mother. We would argue that the juvenile court applied an incorrect standard to the evidence and was incorrect in relying on a lack of treatment history with the child. There's nothing in Daniel D. or in Ray Brian B. that requires a treatment history with a child in order for a witness to establish and testify that there is a risk of harm to the child when testifying in open court in the presence of a parent. Children who have been removed from an unwholesome and abusive family home and placed in foster care should not then be forced to undergo further emotional harm and trauma during the judicial proceedings that are seeking to free them from an already harmful situation, especially when there's been evidence presented indicating that there are less traumatic options available. Again, we believe that the juvenile court erred in denying the appellant's request to testify in chambers at the adjudication hearing, requesting that this court reverse that decision and remand with directions allowing the child to testify in chambers. With that, if there are no further questions from the court, I would reserve any time for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Martha Wharton, and I am the attorney for the appellee, Letitia Jackson, the natural mother. The appellee's argument is twofold. First of all, I would argue that the Court of Appeals does not have jurisdiction to hear this appeal. And even if the Court of Appeals does have jurisdiction, I would argue that the trial court's order denying the motion for in-chambers testimony should stand. In regards to my first argument, I believe the appellate court should reject this appeal for lack of jurisdiction. As Judge Severs stated earlier, in regards to the substantial right, under statutes and case law, this has to affect a substantial right in a special proceeding. It is a special proceeding. It's part of juvenile court. The question here really is whether this is a substantial right. When we talk about substantial rights here, we talk about a substantial right versus a technical right. A substantial right is one that is necessary for the state to establish the elements of the claim. A technical right is one that only enhances those elements of a claim or a defense. Appellant argues that the child has a right to be free from harm, and then she parlays that right to be free from harm into a child's right to testify in chambers. I think that argument fails in two ways. First of all, it fails because the child has no right to testify in chambers. This is an accommodation that is made by the trial court upon a specific showing of evidence. The child does not have a right under statute or case law to testify in chambers. It also fails because the child actually does not have a right to testify in the case. The child is testifies if the state calls that child to testify as a witness. She is merely a witness in this case. Having the child testify in chambers is not essential to the state's claim. It is a technical matter of where she will testify. The trial court did not bar the child from testifying. It simply stated that the child would not be allowed to testify in chambers. That leaves the state still with several options. The state can choose to not call the child to testify and bring other evidence to prove its claim. And there are other sources of evidence to prove things like this, and some of which was brought forth within the testimony during the motion. Also, the state could choose to call the child to testify in court as opposed to testifying in chambers. But the state nor the guardian ad litem have not been barred from bringing this evidence. They've simply been directed how the evidence must be brought. So I would argue that in chambers testimony is not essential to the state's claim and merely enhances the state's claim. The state and the guardian ad litem would prefer for the child to testify in chambers, but it is not necessary for the case to proceed.
If this appeal were not filed and the trial court ruled as it did and the child were not called as a witness and the trial court found that the evidence was insufficient, does the state have a remedy at that point?
An appeal. And I think that it could be heard on appeal, and then if the appellate court disagreed with the trial court, it could be sent back for retrial. I think in this case, the appellant talks a lot about the best interest of the child, and really it's the crux of their argument. But I think there's an argument to be made that it's in the best interest of the mother, the child, and the court to find that a motions for in-chambers testimony is not a final appealable order. Juvenile cases need to be resolved in a speedy and efficient manner, and allowing for such pretrial appeals stalls the whole process of reunification and rehabilitation. In this case, these children will have been removed from the home for almost a year by the time we get back to trial, and the mother will not even have been shown at that point to have committed these alleged acts of abuse. Under Section 43278, The statute provides for adjudication hearings on cases such as these to be held within 90 days. And that is because it is important for these things to be heard in a speedy manner, both for the child and the parent and the court. And although there is case law that allows that to be extended for good cause, I think extending it from 90 days to 1 year is a significant jump in time, especially when you're talking about separating small children from their parent. I think the appellant also fails to acknowledge the mother's due process rights in this. But the law is very clear that the mother does have a fundamental liberty interest in being with her child, and she maintains that interest through the process, through the trial. And actually, the parent's due process right is really a major reason for even having the evidentiary hearing on a motion for in-chambers testimony. If the parent didn't have any due process rights, the state could simply declare that every child under a certain age could testify in chambers. But because of the parent's due process rights, which are really important when you're talking about taking away their children, we do have this safeguard in place, and a certain amount of evidence must be shown. I think it's also a matter of judicial efficiency that if this is a final appealable order, we're going to be seeing a lot of appeals pre-trial on these cases where children are removed. They're going to stay removed while all of this gets resolved. I think it's very unusual generally for pre-trial motions and hearings to be called final appealable orders. There are very few that are like that. Finally, I would argue that even if the court decides it does have jurisdiction in this case, that the trial court's order should stand. The witness in this case, if you go back to the record, had very limited insight into the particular facts of this child in this case. Instead, she testified to the theoretical and the hypothetical to make up for such lack of knowledge. Appellant argued there was no time for the therapist to develop a relationship with the child, but I would argue that that is untrue. The child was removed in January, and this hearing was not held until about 6 weeks after the removal, and it wasn't concluded until 2 months after the removal. This therapist first met with the child on February 5th of this year, and we didn't go into court for this motion hearing until the middle of March. So that leaves 6 to 8 weeks' time when this therapist could have repeatedly met with this child. So to call that an impossible task is simply untrue. The therapist in this case, if you look at the record, testifies to some future difficulties and some emotional problems. She really failed to specify any specific emotional problems in any appreciable manner or any future difficulties. Specifically, it's just a very vague description of what would possibly happen. She also says that it can be very emotionally traumatizing for young children to testify in front of their parents. Again, this is a very generalized and hypothetical way about what harm is done, not even to this child specifically, but to children in general. If this generalized knowledge were enough, I think that the court or the legislature would, like I said before, simply say children under a certain age always testify in chambers. But that is not the law. The law is that it must be shown in each case that the presence of the parents during the testimony would be harmful to the child in interest. And even then, it is still within the discretion of the trial court of whether to allow such testimony. Appellant cites Brian B., and under Brian B., I think you can really distinguish this case. First of all, the therapist in that case had extensive knowledge of the child, including disabilities such as developmental delays in speech and vocabulary, as well as her coarse and fine motor skills. The therapist also testified to specific harms that would occur as a result of the testimony, such as negative behaviors, emotional flashbacks, shutting down completely, dishonesty, emotional upheaval, and getting into trouble. And then she specifically cited what developmental and cognitive delays would contribute to the child's difficulty in testifying. I think after listening to that, when you go back and read the record, you'll see the great difference between the therapist in that case and the therapist in this case. The therapist in that case knew the child she was testifying about. The therapist in this case had a very glancing notion of what this child was about and what her needs were. In fact, I think the more you look at Brian B., the more you will see why Judge Daniels overruled this motion.
Counsel, I'd like to follow up on Judge Siever's question. Assuming that the trial court adhered to its position that we said there was no jurisdiction, the trial court adheres to its position, and the state elects not to call the child at trial, how is the record going to show, and how is an appellate court going to know what the child would have testified to if called?
Well, the state could make an offer of proof as to what the child would testify to. Also, I think other evidence and witnesses may point to what the child would have testified to. And also, there's ample evidence in the record for the motion for in-chambers testimony as to what the child possibly could have testified to.
Okay. Thank you.
I think, finally, appellant suggests repeatedly in her brief and today that the evidence here is unrebutted and undisputed about what the appellee has done to this child. And I would just submit that's absolutely not true. My client actually hasn't even had her day in court for her trial yet. The evidence is certainly not undisputed at this point. We simply haven't had our shot yet to tell the court her side of the story.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our rebuttal time remains.
I think I'd like to first start out by distinguishing Brian B. as defense counsel has in what the therapist in that case was able to offer. I would further distinguish that case with respect to the present case and point out the fact that the children in In re Brian B. were removed from the parental home in October of 2002. And the therapist testified that she began treating the child in January of 2003. The second supplemental petition was then filed in July of 2003. It's unclear from the opinion when this therapist actually offered her opinion and when the hearing took place, but I think one can presume that by the time that particular therapist was able to offer an opinion as to harm that may be upon the child and testifying in chambers, she had already a minimum of 6 to 7 months of a therapeutic relationship with the child. So when addressing the judicial efficiency argument as well, we simply don't have 6 months in every case for a child to establish a therapeutic relationship before a motion for in-chambers can be held. The delay in treatment here was through no fault whatsoever of Marcella. And actually, it's probably a very common situation for juvenile cases when we're running up against a 90-day suggested time frame to hold a trial.
Ms. Novak, would you agree that our general notion is that we are adverse to piecemeal appeals?
I'm sorry.
We're generally adverse to the notion that you can appeal pieces of a case, that we sort of like to have the whole case appealed when it's finished in the trial court.
Certainly, I understand that, Your Honor, but in this situation...
And that there is some policy involved in juvenile cases and moving them through with certain dispatch in the trial court?
Certainly, Your Honor, but we would argue that if the juvenile court had applied the correct standard, and if it's found in this case that the incorrect standard was applied, that the juvenile courts will then be forced to apply the correct standard and these appeals will not occur. I don't see them as being a common situation.
And why won't that also be resolved after full trial using this procedure that I discussed with opposing counsel?
Simply because the harm will have befallen upon the child. I mean, when there's undisputed evidence...
Not if she doesn't testify.
And if she doesn't testify, then we run the risk of the county attorney being unable to prove the allegations in their petition and this child returning home to an abusive environment.
But if you're correct on the standard and there's an appeal filed, do we just reverse and send it back for a new trial and the child gets to testify in chambers? I mean, I guess my point is you have the capacity to avoid, as the child's guardian ad litem, to avoid the harm, don't you, by not having her testify?
Your Honor, this child was the state's primary witness. Their defense counsel refers to additional evidence that could be offered, but there's no case law to establish that additional evidence could be offered, and she doesn't refer to specifically what evidence could be offered in lieu of the child's testimony. But when we're talking about a case of physical abuse and a child has been listed as the state's primary witness, there is no other way but for the testimony of the child to prove the allegations contained in the petition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very well. The cause is submitted and counsel are excused. In our last case this morning,